Well, good morning to you, and a pleasant welcome to the Daily Connection here on KDOV. 5 minutes after 10 o'clock on this Thursday. Tis the final Thursday of the month, as you may have noticed, and that means that it is time once again for exploration into the worlds of church history. And we have our pals Matt McAuliffe and Chris White here, both on the staff at Trail Christian Fellowship. And, yes, we are here today to talk about the Crusades, something that covered hundreds of years, really.
Yes.
And we're going to try to do it in 20 minutes. Impossible.
Ready? Always interesting. You know, technically, Pat, as we're putting the show together, if you were to use the basic theory that something is never over until the last bit of paperwork is finished, the Crusades actually lasted in 1945, because in that day, the very last archdiocese in the world that was still raising money for the Crusade tax actually voted to abolish that. And believe it or not, that archdiocese was the Archdiocese of Colorado in the USA. And they were still raising money for the Crusades up until that very time. So it's a long span of time.
Just about a millennium.
That's right. Yeah.
They have stick-to-itiveness. But
it's amazing. The Crusades really, really have had an impact even on us today, and have so much shaped the world that we live in today. It's almost mind-boggling. You know, Christopher Columbus, of all people, even though the Jerusalem had been taken over by the Muslims long before he set out on his voyage, that was one of his motivations for making that journey. You know, he was not trying to discover America. He was trying to find another route, to go to the Far East. But his idea was, I can find another quicker route to get to Jerusalem for taking holy pilgrimages there. And, so the whole thing about the Crusades and the spirit of them is so much wrapped up throughout our history.
Oh, it's fascinating. It gets into every pore, socially and mentally. As a matter of fact, I'm actually glad that we didn't get to the Crusades until we had a chance to do some of the other programs about the Middle Ages, the Byzantine Empire, the monasticism and
yes.
Middle Ages, because they provide a lot of background that it would be really helpful to have. Well, just for fun, what we're looking at, it's right after the first millennium. It's the 10th, 11th century. Europe's kind of starting to recover. The Vikings have settled down. The barbarians have been chased off.
The Y1K crisis was over.
The Y1K crisis. As a matter of fact, things were doing so well that there was actually some population pressure. The rise of cities, there was a good food supply, even though they'd have famines and disease once in a while. Overall, things were starting to look good. People had enough leisure to begin to turn to examine spiritual and intellectual pursuits. As a matter of fact, this really is. These are the pre-Renaissance days, and there's a lot of mental and spiritual energy happening there. People began to take their spirituality a good deal more seriously. It's the first time they really were examining their own walks, and that was one of the critical factors leading up to the Crusades. Another one was the fact that, remember the Byzantine Empire we talked about?
Yes,
it the successor to Rome, and it was starting to crumble. Things were just going badly, and it was just collapsing of its own weight. And as a matter of fact, a battle no one has ever heard of, except scholars, occurred in Turkey in the year 1071 that was critical. The Byzantine army marched out to defend the borders of its empire, like it always had for years, mm-hmm. hundreds and hundreds of years. And the Seljuk Turks, a small army of Seljuk Turks, wiped it out at a place called Manzikert.
Wow.
And that is hugely important because it signaled pretty much the end of the dominance of the Byzantine Empire, who up till that time owned the Holy Land, owned Turkey, all that whole area. So what we got is the Muslim incursion, the Turks, they're really starting to knock on the doors of Europe, and folks are starting to get worried. The Byzantines are going downhill. Europe's starting to feel its muscle. And the last real ingredient in this stew is the rise of a powerful papacy. The popes had, just a few years before that, they had first one of the Holy Roman emperors, and were beginning to exert serious political control. They weren't just spiritual leaders anymore. They were exerting serious temporal, earthly control and political power, which leads us, actually, to the pope that kicked this off was old Urban.
That's right. And one of the other things that was definitely going on that became a real change, you got to remember now that, we had the church and the state, and then by this time, the church is the state.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a real shift in some of the thinking as well. And one of the major shifts in thinking that happened was in this whole area known as the theory of just war. Back in the 4th century, when Constantine had, you know, became a Christian emperor, mm-hmm. one of the things they looked to the church for was guidance in the use of war. And Augustine started this theory, and it's been affirmed even up through the Protestant reformers. But basically, the doctrine of just war, if I could sum it up in two lines, would be just recognizing that war was a necessity in certain circumstances, but it mostly regulated the unbridled use of war and tried to mitigate some of its evil effects by placing limits on who may fight and for how long and to what degree. And this goes on for, you know, for centuries. This is embraced by the church. But then come around the 9th and 10th centuries, a new view began to be accepted, and that was that the church and state were one, and that Christ's kingdom could be expanded through political structures, and as a subcategory of that, through war. And thus, if war could be used to expand the kingdom of Christendom, then it would be a good use of war, and it would become necessary. And so this becomes a very thinkable thing.
Wow.
In the minds of the scholars of the church.
Chris, wasn't it even compared to a surgeon, the violence a surgeon does to a patient when he amputates
exactly.
a gangrenous leg?
A higher good would be accomplished
mm-hmm.
if we did this war, and then we could Christianize these people. And so what was once never, never used at all became something that was actually part of the belief system of the church, is that Christendom could be expanded through politics instead of through missionary activity, which up until that time, the church had only expanded by missionary activity.
Wow, and that probably all started way back with Constantine, huh? When he said, I'm going to be a Christian, and so is everybody else.
Absolutely.
Okay, and so now it's about 600-700 years later, and we have this really coming to fruition. That was a great explanation. So we had all that mixed into the stew, and then we come down to Pope Urban.
That's right.
Urban II, there had been other political popes, but he was the first to really start recognizing that political power is a thing that is involved with the raising of armies and consolidating power. And in all fairness, we need to remember that it was the Byzantine emperor that sent a message to the Pope, Urban, saying, hey, we're getting wiped out. Now, I know that we're not on speaking terms. We just excommunicated each other a few years ago.
That was the Great Schism. The Great Schism had just happened about 20 years before this.
But you guys are Christians like us, and we're getting wiped out by these Turks and Muslims. Will you please come help us? And so really, the Crusades must be viewed also as a response to an invitation, a lawful and legitimate invitation. But Urban responds to this, and he starts making the tour around France and everything, and for some strange reason, he gets to the town of Clermont in November of 1095 and is addressing people in the cathedral, and it just goes wacko. I mean,
people respond. Well, as a matter of fact, you know, Urban is believed had in mind that he wanted to raise a company of knights, but this went way beyond that. It became a mass movement of men, women, and children, and everybody wanting to get in on this thing. And at the time of the First Crusade, I think they said somewhere upwards of 200,000 people left Europe. And then by the time they arrived in Constantinople, there was only about 7,000.
You know, it was a horrible journey. I mean, it was 2,000 miles. It was no food, no water, bandits, death, disease. You can't imagine. There was no good reason to go except that, as Urban said, God wills it. And it was off and running. And as Christopher said, he wanted a regiment. He got armies. And the first one, I mean, here all the real soldiers and knights are taking a little time to get ready and polish their stuff. And, you know, it takes a lot of money. So they're selling their lands and buying their chargers and getting their equipment. And the peasants are not waiting for them. The people, Peter the Hermit, a guy, just a itinerant evangelist, is wandering around. He gets everybody whipped up, and as Christopher said, almost 250,000 people start off, and these are
ill-prepared, ill-clad, ill-trained.
Gracious,
you know, but
goodness.
they have the good motivation in their heart that, you know. And one of the things that maybe we kind of glossed over too is that part of this was fueled by, for centuries, Christians have always been able to go on pilgrimages into the Holy Land, even though the Muslims controlled the area. They always had a sensitivity because they knew that Christians were, akin to them in some way, and they knew that Christians wanted to visit the holy shrines and holy sites. And so Christians have always been making pilgrimages, if you will, you know, long before we had Israel tours, you know, in five-star hotels over there, people made this pilgrimage. And part of the motivation was that was the sense that this was all closing down on them. And actually, that had
happened.
And that's
a fair statement. The Muslims, well, the Turks, they were much worse than just your regular Muslims. They were torturing and killing pilgrims. They were denying access. So there were some understandable hot tempers in Europe that were being denied access to the most important sites in our culture.
So was Byzantine Empire still pretty much most of Turkey and the Eastern Europe and kind of
on the map,
East?
But not in reality.
It was crumbling.
It was crumbling away. Right.
Yeah.
In reality, the Turks pretty much owned that
and they
area.
They were from the East, the Turks?
Actually, Russia. They came down from Russia. And
Turkmenistan?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Because Islam was experiencing kind of a golden age, and they were kind of relaxed and fat and sassy and were actually fighting amongst themselves. The Turks were just a part of that. So that's one of the reasons the Crusades actually succeeded at first. So I should mention, by the way, that the Peasants' Crusade was completely obliterated.
There's not
a single survivor, except Peter the Hermit. I think for some strange reason he got away.
We had to come back and start that group, Herman's Hermits, later on. But, you know, one of the other things that definitely out of that first crusade was the fact that the fighting was extremely vicious.
It
really became a bloodbath and a frenzy. And one of the things that was unheard of that did happen was the fact that the Crusaders did attack women and children, which was something that the just war theory had prohibited. But things really got out of hand. And as a matter of fact, that is the wound that was left on the Muslim world that remains to this day, is the fact that we would do the unthinkable. Mm-hmm. And the fighting from that point on really was a quite a dirty way to do war.
Yeah, nobody came out of this with clean petticoats. The Muslims were just as bad. The problem was you get a big group of folks traveling across over land, and they're all fired up with this big idea.
And fighting over religion.
Oh, my gosh. Half of what killed them was as the peasants were moving in the First Crusade, was moving overland down the Danube to get to Turkey. They were killing the Jews, you know, they would run out of food, and so they'd sack and burn a village, you know, and these are Christian folks they're wiping out, and everybody did this. It just got worse and worse. By the time they actually got to the Holy Land, now the first crusade that followed the peasants got wiped out.
They were wiped out on the way?
Yes, totally. They never made it 100 miles out of Constantinople.
Okay.
The first crusade, though, was a little more organized. It's actually about 7 or 8 different armies that joined together and met in Constantinople and traveled overland. They had some miraculous successes. Now, they were also pretty brutal, but they were more focused on military objectives. They would go from one strong point to another, and through, I gotta say, a series of miraculous events, ended up capturing Antioch and then Jerusalem, stunned the Muslim world. The Muslims are still fighting amongst themselves, and all of a sudden they look over and say, whoa, what happened there?
And one of the things they also did was they set up these states, ancient colonies or countries.
The County of Antioch.
And Jerusalem became known as the colony of Outremer, which means across the sea. And it was actually at one point a Christian nation or city-state, you want to call it, and a little-known fact.
And its own church.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, that would probably be a good million-dollar question, you know, on who wants to be a millionaire.
So
there was, you know, as they did this, they actually established a government and had set up a little Christian kingdom in the Holy Land.
And so they're just kind of holding on by their fingernails here. They've got enough strength to just do that. They send to Europe, say, hey, help us out. And so Europe sends a series of armies that all get wiped out. And what that brings us to is the only other crusade, really, that has any serious significance. That's the Third Crusade. This is the one everybody's heard about. This is Richard the Lionheart, Robin Hood, King John.
He's always gone.
Ivanhoe. Absolutely. Fighting a real interesting character, Saladin, who is a brilliant warrior. We don't have time to go into it, but a very admirable man in charge of the Muslim armies, back and forth. As a matter of fact, what are some of the things?
They were, Saladin and Richard were actually quite good fighters, and they had a high degree of respect for one another, but they were also quite the diplomats, if you will. And Saladin actually wanted to work a way at which Richard and him could both meet their objectives. And so he actually proposed to King Richard that King Richard, the Lionheart, would marry his sister. And that way, they could have this marital alliance where they couldn't go to war with with each other anymore because they were related by marriage. And then what he would do was he would offer to give Richard the Lionheart a Jerusalem as a wedding present. The offer was on the table, but unfortunately Richard, you know, was not going to have a marital alliance. He was a very spiritual man and probably one of the most religious of all the kings of the Holy Roman Empire, and he didn't do it. And, you know, one wonders what would have been the effect on the history of the Middle East had that happened, had there been peace between Christians and Muslims that whole time. Because of this marital alliance.
It was kind of a high water mark. What they ended up with was Saladin and Richard negotiated a truce allowing pilgrims to come into Jerusalem. And after that, it just
went downhill
from there.
There were other crusades, but they eventually degenerated into really just kind of taking care of heretics. There was actually a crusade launched within Christendom against heretics, you know, which one could arguably say, you know, led to the use of Inquisition and that sort of thing that we've talked about in previous shows.
Oh, there were the Children's Crusades where one or two supposedly inspired children gathered 30,000 children and they marched down to the sea and got onto ships and sailed off to oblivion and slavery. So, and just nobody ever heard of them again. It was just some very interesting things going on.
So we need to think of the Crusades as really kind of a movement that happened over time, you know, rather than these, you know, very sharp, delineated, you know, you have those things, but there's a constant barrage of people going down in groups, and this is happening over a period of several hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
So.
You bet. Well, and just for fun, let's just take a minute, look at the typical crusader. Now, 90% of the crusaders were just peasants with pikes. They were just out to get some good credit with God and defend the Holy Land. And these are all pretty good reasons. The crusading knights, though, typically, as a young guy, he's probably French. He's probably the second or third son down the line because primogeniture, the law there, said the first son inherits everything. So if you're a second or third son and you want property or wealth, well, you go adventuring for it. He's probably pretty wealthy. It costs a lot of money. And he's good at battle. And so 10% of the crusading armies were knights, 90% were the peasants. And the motivation, not only were they legitimately trying to defend God's house and Christians and had received that invitation, but they were also offered, traditionally, pilgrims always got privileges and remission of sins. That was just part of it. Well, the papacy and Bernard of Clairvaux all started sponsoring, if you guys go on the Crusades, will offer remission for all of your sins.
Or a time out of purgatory, depending on, you know, what the case was needed. This begins what we know as indulgences, which later, you know, of course, got out of hand.
Oh, don't even go there.
And Martin Luther addresses that later on in the history of the church.
But this is kind of where it started.
This is where it all starts.
But I think it's important for us to remember, instead of being really judgmental of the Crusaders, we need to remember they were operating very sincerely, most of them. There were some awful guys on both sides. But for the most part, they were undergoing horrible things for no material gain. They were thinking of this in terms of a spiritual gain. And when we are tempted to judge them and make themselves available for that, we need to look at it in terms of we've kind of done the same thing. One of our legacies in the Christian world is a crusading ethic, which has even bled over into our culture in America. My gosh, into Kuwait, you know, and I know there were some snide commercial motivations for that, but a lot of popular spiritual, just let's go help the underdog guy that's getting beat up. Mogadishu was another example. Mm-hmm. So we're not completely removed from these motivations. We're not so sophisticated that we're above these things.
And certainly there's a legacy that a lot of people don't realize right off the bat was the fact that these crusaders left Europe, which was a fairly insular place, and went to the Middle East, or actually at the time it would just be the East. It's the far western part of Asia. And they came into contact with these other cultures, and life was never the same. They brought back tastes for things and ideas and thoughts that really resulted in the Renaissance of Europe. And the new ideas, and so there was actually an infusion. You know, Western civilization always had an energy behind it, but didn't always have a lot of intelligence. And there was an intelligence and a line of thinking and things brought into Western Europe, which really revitalized it and makes it, we all inherit that
to this day. Yeah, fueled the commercial expansion of places like Venice and Genoa that were really little commercial empires, and they ended up, there was such a huge demand now for the fruits and the fabrics and the steel and the culture and the ideas, the astrology, the medicine, everything the East was experiencing a golden age in, and oh my goodness, did they make do with that. As a matter of fact, Venice and Genoa, the merchants there were... they were mercenary enough to actually sidetrack the Fourth Crusade, as you remember, and just take a little profitable side trip to wipe out Constantinople. I mean, it's closer than the Holy Land, and there's a lot of valuable things there, and we can come up with a couple good justifications politically, so let's just go do that.
That was number four, huh?
Oh, that was the end of the East-West relationship.
Yeah, that pretty much put it down. And, you know, the other area that's an interesting thing to trace back is also just the general distrust between Christians and Muslims, and between Western civilization and the Islamic civilization on both sides. Because, you know, a lot has, of course, been made of how, you know, Christians were, you know, wiping out Muslim people, innocent Muslim people. But the fact is the Muslims also did the very exact same thing. I remember in one particular battle, over 60,000 Christians were massacred by Muslim people. And there is a general distrust, you know, really between the two peoples that remains even to this day. And that has its roots all the way back into the Crusades.
It sure does.
Fascinating history. You can go to those lands. I don't know where these are, but I know that there are Western-style castles still in that part of the world from the Crusades.
Yeah.
The women in Bethlehem to this day wear that conical hat that the ladies in the old Middle Ages used to wear in England. You can go and see that. It's very,
and
very
crack chevalier.
Oh, yeah.
That's the one. Yeah.
The Crusader Castle. There's
so many stories, Pat. I wish we could talk more about Saladin. I wish we could talk, you know, the women crusaders that went and fought shoulder to shoulder with the men. The children's crusade there. It's just too big.
Well, when was Crusade number 3? We started 1095 in Clermont in France. That was the first one, and then that was the Peasant Crusade.
The Third Crusade finished, it started up, well, the Second Crusade just petered out about 1148, 1150. In 1187, Saladin, the guy we're talking about, took over Jerusalem again and had a huge defeat of the Crusaders right above the Sea of Galilee on the Horns of Hattin, a very famous battle in which the poor old knights wandering around in their 300 pounds of armor were just getting beat up by these Arab archers that stood off like, you know, the Indians and colonists in the American Revolution and just took them out. They set fire to the grass and burned these guys up. It was a horrible defeat. And in response to that, Richard the Lionheart started the Third Crusade in 1187, and took the guys back and took most of the territory back. But, we could just go on.
And then we had Prince John in England Robin Hood and Ivanhoe.
You know that those aren't true, Pat. No, those are just stories.
What? Hey, we got 1 minute exactly.
Okay, we have got to recommend a book. Christopher and I are both really, really hot to trot about this book called God Wills It. We must have used 20, 30 different source books. But this book is by W.B. Bartlett, and I'm sure is widely available. It really reads well. It's not boring, and it goes into a detail that we would just give anything to give you guys right now.
And closing with a quote from T.S. Eliot.
Amen.
Among the Crusaders were a few good men, many who were evil, most who were neither, like all men in all places.
That's a good one. Thank you, T.S., a wise man. Well, you know what? Thanks again to Chris White and Matt McAuliffe, two pals well versed here in these matters historical, and I hope we'll come back again next month. I know we will.
We will. John Wesley's up next month.
John Wesley. All right. A good one. Right now, it's time for In Touch with Charles Stanley. I'm Pat Daly. Lord bless you today. If you're able, some...